Putting the Pieces Together, A Scientific Approach to Grazing Education, Dennis Hancock, University of Georgia.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity here today to kind of capstone this presentation or the symposium. First of all, let me freely admit that to be standing in Texas and talking on this particular subject is for me to be doing that rather than Imani Roquette or somebody like that. I feel like I'm preaching to the crowd a little bit here. But I think that my observations and the way that I handle our grazing schools have some benefit to this and some additions to add to this. And I would say that, you know, we've heard a lot about some of the research that's out there and a lot of top-shelf research. You know, and being from Kentucky and the land of bourbon, I'm very familiar with the top-shelf stuff, you know. But it's important that it's important from that standpoint to every now and then take it off that top shelf. The problem is that sometimes a lot of it stays up on the top shelf. And we never really try to see how this fits in the real world and figure out how to do that. And what I'm going to propose today is a way that we can use to interpret that and bring that to our producers and allow them the critical thinking skills and the tools that's necessary to be able to walk through that. So not just looking at these four pieces of the puzzle that we tend to, as forage agronomists, tend to focus on of gain per acre or gain per hectare, average daily gain, stocking days, and stocking rate, but also thinking about it in a larger framework here. Looking at the whole system, not just the stocking method. So over the next few minutes, I'd like to visit with you on a few issues with regard to what I think are the elements of a science-based grazing education effort. And this is not just for producers, okay, also for our students, our undergraduate and graduate students. The principles, I think, what I'm going to relay is mainly from an extension bent, but I think it has to do with the way that we approach our training of our undergraduate and graduate students. Certainly, we need to spend some time in those trainings to spend some time talking about the key factors, the key elements. But more importantly, I think, and as we go along, I hope to illustrate this, it's important for us to focus on how those factors interact and the interdependency of those factors on one another. The second thing that I really want to visit with you about is providing those tools that allow for critical thinking. And an example of how we use what we used to call grazing arithmetic until I finally realized that our math aversion is such that no one really wants to do arithmetic, that we call it something else nowadays. It's still the same thing. But we use that model, that those equations that we have, that we all use in grazing schools, to critically evaluate some of these novel grazing methods. And I'm going to go through an example here with the mob stocking and getting at some of those questions that Howard was raising with regard to whether or not we're actually seeing or would anticipate an increase in overall stocking rate. There's a difference between stocking density and stocking rate. I'd also like to share with you the impact of some of these programs, how those science-based programs are being accepted by the producers, what changes have they made, and what teaching tools are most effective. And during that discussion, I'd also like to offer some additional insight from some follow-up evaluations that have been done both at the University of Georgia and the University of Missouri on their grazing schools over the past several years. Talk about the change in goals of some of those producers, and also look at what has changed or what is their main information sources that they use for getting and gathering information about grazing management. Now, all of us that have some instruction role, either in the classroom or in extension, have some sort of organizational chart here where we talk about the different elements of a grazing system, the forage species, the animal need, forage growth, the soil environment, and so forth, and ultimately coming down with an animal outcome here through grazing behavior and manipulating forage intake and supplementation to get to an animal outcome of meat, milk, or fiber. But the issue here is not those straight unidirectional arrows. It's the interactions that occur. It's how there's feedback and a domino effect. If you change one thing, you change many things. And as we go through this, it's important, especially when we're instructing our producers, to start with those elements, but also to recognize that that's just part of the system and that there are other elements that are at play here. The economics that surround this whole issue, and then ultimately the environmental impacts, whether that be on the local level or in global climate change even. So critical thinking, in my opinion, is the most important part of these programs, is encouraging them and providing them tools to be able to critically think. Because these systems are very dynamic and complex, and because of their interdependent parts, we need to place an emphasis as much as possible on those interdependent parts and not just on the elements themselves. And the way that we have to do this is to provide some decision support tools to allow them to go through this in their own, you know, taking out one piece of puzzle at the time and then investigating it and seeing how it fits with the other parts of the system. So what are some of the tools that we generally provide, or what I think are important to provide to participants in either training or as students who are going through the programs? First of all, we need some estimation of forage production in the region that you're working in. These are fairly common. We see a lot of these decision support tools around. Recently, we've developed one for the website that is using actual on-farm clipping data that we've been doing following around cows, or actually going before the cows go into certain paddocks and taking clippings. So we actually have real data, both before and after, to actually simulate what they're grazing. There are also other models out there like sea graze and the pasture land management system, estimates of daily forage need. There are many, many calculators that are out there that we would provide them. Then there are also, you know, these concepts with regard to persistence and our grazing management impacts on persistence. Both demonstrating these conceptually on, you know, on the chalkboard or on the PowerPoint, but increasingly we're finding that what's really helpful is to set up these demonstrations ahead of time and to show them, take them out in a pasture with those cattle or grazing animals out there, and really demonstrate what's going on. There's no substitute for seeing it. The other thing to do, the other tool that we really focus on, and for me, I think that this is the heart of grazing management, is the forage curve. And when you start really seeing forage management in through this lens of the forage growth curve, I think it begins to make a whole lot more sense. So we start, of course, with some conceptual data, and then we work into some real data, going back to the data sets we've been collecting following around some cows. It's important to share that data with them, too. And I know Dave Barker and the group at Ohio State have done a great job with demonstrating this also in a conceptual way, looking at herbage accumulation rate with regard to pasture mass. And I'm really impressed with that research and the modeling efforts that are going into that. So, again, providing that as a conceptual framework. But there's no substitute for having that producer to actually go out and take some data themselves on their own farm and understand how that relates back to their forage management. So we spend actually quite a bit of time talking about measuring forage, using a rising plate meter, using that old grazing stick. Even if it's a rather rudimentary way of measuring forage, once they begin doing this, and it's sometimes difficult to convince them to do it, of course. This is not always in their mindset. But once they start seeing that data and start using that to make some changes, it's important, I think, to allow them to see that and so that they can see how that affects their management. So we spend quite a bit of time teaching them how to do that. We actually have a feed wedge or grazing wedge calculator. It's an Excel spreadsheet that does this automatically, where we set they record their data, and they can do this however frequently they want to, but we recommend weekly. We have, for different forage species, recommended post-grazing residual heights. pre-grazing targets for those forage species. And then the line at an angle there sets the benchmark for the target growth rate for those species. And if it differs from that, we can then begin to manage that appropriately and talk about management strategies to deal with that. And we actually have a fair number of our producers that are starting to do this, particularly in our dairies, the pasture-based dairies. That's the most important part of their operation. And when they start doing that, they realize just how important it is to their bottom line. Another tool in the toolbox, I think, that we is necessary is the paddock planning process. And this is something that until they really start seeing it visually, not just in concept, not just in rules of thumb about where to place water and where to put your shade or try to put your gaps and that sort of thing into your rotational system, until they really see it on their own farm, it really doesn't catch with them. So the Google Earth program that's out there free on the web now has a lot of functionality to it. You can import topo maps to that. You can import soils maps to that, all free of charge. You can calculate acreage. There are many, many things that you can do with that, and they can zoom right in on their farm and draw it up and with some tutoring and some advice and then going out and thinking about how that's really going to work on their farm, they can begin to come up with something that really will work well. But the point that I really want to spend the most time talking about is this whole idea of the grazing arithmetic. And again, it's not something that our producers are all that keen on doing math, you know, but we do make them do a little bit. Most of this we simplify in as much as possible. And down here at the bottom, this is a slide that I use in our grazing school. Down here at the bottom, I have a link where I would open up the Excel spreadsheet that we have. In the interest of time, I'm not going to do that here, but this is all available on our website if you'd like to go see it. But basically, if you recall if you've spent any time with grazing schools or done any grazing management training, there are three basic equations. There's the number of paddocks, and that's defined by the number of days of rest and the days that you're going to be in a paddock. And then there's also the paddock size is defined by what is the animal needs, how long they're going to be in there, and then what is available in that paddock, and then some estimation of how efficient that grazing is, how much of that is standing that they're actually going to be able to utilize. But there's a third equation here that's kind of implicit. It's never really one that we talk that much about. But obviously, if you multiply paddock size by the number of paddocks that you have, then you're going to end up with an estimation of acres that would be grazed. So these can all be summarized essentially in one overall grazing equation. And this is, to me, this is a very powerful tool. It's not something that I guess we spend very much time talking about except for in grazing schools, but I think getting back to some of the things that Lynn said earlier in his presentation, there's a certain amount of information that we need to collect about any kind of grazing method that we're comparing. And ultimately, if we can't plug it into and fill up every variable in this equation, we may not be able to do justice of comparing different grazing methods and different grazing systems overall. But what we use this for is examining different systems and looking at, for example, changes in a grazing system or more specifically in a grazing method, looking at differences in rest period and days in paddock and that sort of thing, changes in supplementation rate. And I'll go through an example here in just a minute where we do that particularly for our dairy producers. But it's important to realize that in a system like this, we're dealing with very dynamic, interdependent parts. So if, for example, you change the day of rest, the days of rest, you're going to change forage allowance, for example. You're going to change for a grazing efficiency because some of that they're going to be less likely to consume. So there are multiple things here that are co-dependent or interdependent upon one another. So let's go through an example here, and we've all talked about in various definitions this mob stocking or ultra-high stock density grazing. And, you know, I think it's important to take this seriously and actually compare it on its merits. What is it really talking about? And I'm going to go through some assumptions that I've heard or read about in the blogosphere, seen in person in Georgia on the farms that are practicing this. Generally speaking, what we're talking about in this ultra-high stocking density is greater than 80,000 pounds of body weight to the acre. A lot of times we're talking about 200,000 pounds or more. The time in paddock is relatively short, less than 12 hours. Sometimes it's 8 hours. Very laborious, and Greg did a great job of talking about how expensive this labor component is to the overall system. Then strip grazing or strip stocking, where we're using both a front and back fence, and that's usually what they're doing in this particular instance, and giving very long rest periods. Very long rest periods, and typically what we're talking about there is more than 75 days. So usually they're dealing with some very mature forage. It does have a very well-developed root system. If it's more than rotational grazing or rotational stocking, I'm not sure if that's greater than a rotational stocking. I'll get into that more later. And then there's this concept of there being a high amount of total energy per acre. Well, that may or may not be true, but there may not necessarily be any more digestible energy per acre. So that could be a component of it too. Now, one of the things that they talk about also is the mob grazing behavior. The behavior of those animals when they're turned into a paddock like this in large mobs, where they're expected to eat that forage in a very short amount of time. So vigorous consumption, relatively low selectivity, although if we're maintaining the same amount of gain, as Greg was talking about earlier, it's important that we maintain animal performance, so we can't go too far down the road of reducing their selectivity. But there are also some challenges here with regard to efficiency, whether or not they're utilizing all of that forage that's out there. Now, this weed issue is becoming less problematic. It's one of the major issues that they highlight. But frankly, we also see that in rotational stocking as well. But these are some of the things that are talked about in the blogosphere and in popular press about mob stocking. But the big issue for them, and for me, and for many of us that work in this area, is taking care of the soil. And we'll talk more about this at the very end. But building soil organic matter and fertility is one of their big hooks that they cling to, that they hang their hat on, about this overall system. Okay, so let's take a look at this example using some basic, classic example that you might pull off of a website somewhere. Where a producer's talking about their system. 200,000 pounds of body weight to the acre, 90 days of rest, so that's giving them 3 grazings per year as a general rule, moving every 8 hours, taking a third and tromping a third. All right, this is a common refrain with those who practice this, and there's some logic behind that, or supposed logic anyway, to tromp two-thirds of that. But the reality is that they're only utilizing, effectively, by definition, only 33% of the allocated forage. So let's plug in some cow-calf pairs here. 125 cow-calf pairs, 1,600 pounds of total body weight, 2% of the body weight, third of a day in a paddock, 90 days of rest. I'm going to assume about 4,000 pounds of dry matter being available per acre and 33% efficiency for a total of 274 acres. So how does this work out? Well, stock density is very high, 125 pairs. We're talking 200,000 pounds of body weight per acre here. So a huge amount of stock density. But when you go to stocking rate becomes a little less impressive. 125 pairs on 274 acres is one cow-calf pair for every 2.2 acres. Then we count in how much hay we need, and this is some very heroic assumptions with regard to hay production and utilization. But nonetheless, we tack that in. I'm trying to be as conservative as I can here. We're looking at, sorry for the glitch here with the graphics, but 125 head, with 274 plus 32 acres, gives us one cow-calf pair for every 2.4 acres in total. Okay? Now, you can plug in whatever you want to in that and come up with your own situation for your own state, but this is what typically we would see in Georgia, and I'm going to give you some results of those calculations from what we typically see in Georgia. For an additional to the ultra-high stocking density, these are the same basic scenarios of how I calculated this is basically the same. The overall numbers are going to be slightly different because these are using what's more typical for Georgia, not necessarily what you might find on as a common scenario in the popular press. And I express this a little bit different. I'm expressing this in animal units per acre, okay, instead of cows per cow-calf pair. You're making me nervous over there, Craig. You're going to kick me in the rear end here. If I don't... So here's our continuous stocking. So continuous stocking is not very impressive at all. I mean, we have relatively low stock density, but also our stocking rate is relatively low. And we could argue about whether or not that's economically feasible or not. And in some cases, it probably is more economically feasible for those producers to be continuously stocking. But this is what is very typical for us in Georgia on rotational stocking. Looking at about 10 animals per animal units per acre and a stock density at any one time, about one animal unit per acre under rotational stock. Our dairy animals are even higher than that. Our dairy, pasture-based dairies, usually our stocking rate is about 2 to 2.2 animal units per acre on irrigated, rotationally grazed pastures. Now, granted, that's about 30 to 40% supplementation. Their ration is being supplemented that much. But nonetheless, we have some very high stocking rate potential here. But this ultra-high stocking density for us in the southeast does not bode very well in based on my calculations. I don't have, you know, good replicated research. There's no such data out there on these systems comparing all three of them. But getting back to this system and thinking about how we could pick apart individual parts of this and examine it a little closer, let's focus here for just a minute on the supplementation strategy, how we might be able to adapt to that. And I mentioned that we do this with our dairy cows. And just in the interest of time, I'm going to just quickly go through the considerations that we talk about in terms of defining substitution rate. But what I wanted really to get to is illustrating how we take this overall grazing equation, set up some different scenarios with regard to available forage and expected grazing efficiency and different base stocking rates, and then based on how much supplementation or substitution rate we get with our supplement, we can increase or effectively change our stocking rate. Now, I don't have time to go into the detail. We spend, with our dairy producers, probably 30 minutes going through this slide, so I don't have time to go through that, but I just would suffice it to say that this is a tool that allows us to be able to do that, and this is something that our producers had asked us about. Let me see if I can go back here real quick. This is something our producers had asked us about, is to develop a way that we could actually model some change in supplementation. And how's that going to affect our stocking rate? So that information is also on our website, on our grazing school page. Now, the last few slides here, I want to spend some time talking about the impact of our grazing schools. And I'm going to give you some data from Georgia, surveying our producers who participated in 2007 to 2010, and then some data that Craig and Rob shared with me from Missouri, from producers who attended in 2000 to 2002 and evaluated in 2005. So I've kind of given you the crib note version of this already. This was a 2011 online survey that we did for the University of Georgia. I emphasize here, online survey. This was all done by the internet, so that influences our results, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The other thing that could influence our results, and particularly in light of comparing that to the Missouri data, is that our evaluation was done 1 to 3 years after the grazing school. And some of these producers actually had only been 6 months since they participated in grazing school. We surveyed 147 participants, sending 126 valid emails. Some of the email addresses had changed in the even a relatively short amount of time. We got 41 completed surveys, return rate of about 33%, which is actually pretty good for these kinds of surveys. The Missouri study was, our survey was actually sent out in 2005. It was a mailed survey, so a little bit different way of collecting that data. There's some time difference here, too. I think there's some changes that have occurred just in the last few years in internet usage and the extent to which we use the internet. But this was 3 to 5 years after grazing school, so they've had more opportunity to change their system. They chose 82 randomly selected participants. One of those persons had deceased. They had 31 completed for a return rate of 38.3%. Okay, so let's go through this. What are the percentage of the grazing school graduates that practice some sort of managed grazing system following the grazing schools? And this excluded any that were already practicing or any that are not farming, including, like, for example, extension agents or NRCS personnel that participated but aren't actually farming on their own. What we found in Georgia is that about 88% of our respondents indicated that they were actually practicing a managed grazing system since the grazing school. In Missouri, that number jumped up to 96%. A little bit more time there, perhaps, to digest that, but also maybe they're even better at their grazing schools. The numbers were the other way around. I would claim that I was better anyway. Average acres in managed grazing before and after grazing school. We had 80, they had 90, and there was a jump of 78% for us and 138% there in Missouri. Pretty substantial impact on the number of acres that are being under a managed grazing system. Percent change in net farm income. This is the one that really excited me, Greg, is actually seeing the impact that we're having on their economics. And by the way, I admitted to Greg last night that I'm a closet economist. I'm not a very good one, but I do like to see these numbers. And 20% indicated in our case, more than 30% increase in their net farm income. 20 to 30% increase in income here, that was the predominant one for Missouri. Almost 50% of their producers indicated a pretty substantial increase in their net farm income. Do you attribute most of the previously mentioned changes or differences to practices that you learned about in grazing school? And again, the overwhelming answer, of course, was that they did. Many, of course, did say no in this particular instance, but many times what that was related to was that they had already set up a managed grazing system, or that they had worked with our specialist for several years already, or that they, in this particular instance, this producer, this was one that had only been out of grazing school about 6 months, and they were working off farm, which is common for many of these producers, and just had not had the time to fully implement the system yet. Now here's something kind of interesting, the primary sources of grazing and forage management information. Now you can just discount this top line because we were an extension group seeking input here, and they obviously would hope indicate that we were providing some of their needs. But look at some of the other numbers that gravitate to the top. A lot of emphasis is placed on, we already knew this, that the magazines and popular press articles are very important to them. Internet has become increasingly important, and it's important to note here that the difference between Georgia and Missouri, I don't know if our guys use the internet more than you guys do, or maybe there's not a good internet access in Missouri, but you have to go out and crank the electric. No, actually what I think is the difference here is that their study was in 2005 and ours was in 2011, and even in 6 years difference in time, there's been a drastic difference in the acceptance and utilization of the internet. What was also surprising to me is what was not sought, or what they did not see as being valuable sources of information as much. Now, they didn't put as much stock in their professional consultants, their farm supply stores, or their veterinarian, or their web blogs. The web blogs is something that I think is kind of interesting too. Okay, where would they prefer to get their information? Where would they prefer to get their information? Well, still overwhelmingly, field days and tours are the popular things. They want to see it, touch it, feel it, smell it, you know, before they actually put it on their own farm. Internet is, again, rising to the top, especially the differences in the years of the two surveys and email newsletters. Email newsletters really, in my opinion, probably are taking the place of mailed newsletters. Notice here that webinars, even though there hasn't been much progress made there, it's still relatively low, but I think that's gaining in prevalence too. But the things that we typically do, like evening meetings and short courses, are not nearly as popular as important to them as field days and things where they can actually see it, or getting information where they can take time and ruminate on it and digest it themselves. So what changes after grazing schools? What kind of goals changes that they have? One thing is that there's a change in thought process. And this is some work that was done following the Pastors for Profit grazing schools in Ohio, looking at the top three reasons for considering an intensive grazing management before or after grazing school. Before, the focus was on increasing productivity, extending the grazing season, and increasing herd size. Afterwards, it was primarily looking at higher profit, better land and soil management, and improved herd health. So the change of mind. And this is, when I saw this, I realized we're on to something. This is changing their perspective, focusing it on those interactions and not the individual factors. Finally, just let me add to this discussion, and I don't have much to add to this, but this concept of taking care of the soil and the soil organic matter and fertility, the key issue. And I'll leave you with this slide, which is some data that we collected on some dairy pastures, rotationally grazed dairy pastures, that had just come out of crop production, been continuously tilled for generations in some very low organic matter soils to begin with, and they'd driven the soil organic matter down to about 1%. After 3 years of a rotationally grazed, rotationally stocked, management intensive grazed pasture, we were up to 2%. A pretty substantial impact on soil organic matter. Now, I'm not saying that's going to continue at that same rate, but it's pretty impressive what can happen in just a short amount of time. This is not mob stocking. This is a traditional rotationally stocked system. This is what's doing that work. It's the roots. The root system is what's contributing to soil organic matter. There's a really good article that just came out in Nature about the contribution of soil organic matter and what's the form and sources of that. It's the roots. The residue on top of the soil surface has very little to do. It's important, don't get me wrong, but it's relatively minuscule compared to the impact of the root systems. A few last things here with regard to our grazing school participants. They indicated that our participation in the grazing school, or their participation in the grazing school, helped them meet their goals of improved soil fertility and health, improve their daily routine and their lifestyle. This is also an important part of sustainability that we need to consider, is their lifestyle. Some parting thoughts, leaving you something to ruminate on. We do not have, and we will never have, and we probably cannot have, all the experimental results and empirical evidence that we need to look at every possible combination. There's too many elements there that are interdependent. So I'm going to be rather provocative here. If that is what your definition of scientific management is, or scientifically based management is, it's very narrow, and it's very naive to think that we, on an experiment station facility, can set up and model that robustly enough to be able to encompass that. So what we need to provide them with is the tools to allow them to use their own common sense and some decision making about that and critical thinking about their system. I'll kind of echo the comments that that Rob started with here, which were that the principles are relatively few. The applications are many, but the principles are few. And the scientific approach, in my opinion, needs to emphasize the elements, the interdependency of those elements, and the tools that we can use to estimate the effect of those changes. So with that, I'll pause for questions. Appreciate your time.
All right, let's take one or two questions for Dennis, and then we'll open it up to all the speakers.
Scott?
Dennis, your comments on the whole idea of the farm stores actually not having much influence. And I'll tell you what I've seen. Most of the farm stores in southern Iowa, the last thing you want to talk about is pasture. It's all corn and beans.
Yep.
And so it really gets minimized. If you walk into a co-op and say anything about ranging pasture, they'll look at you like you have a horn growing out of your head. What are you doing asking such a question here? And it seems like that they also tend to hire people that they're more grain oriented. We don't have a lot of people in co-ops that actually have any foreign experience.
Yeah.
And so I think we get a lot of bad information. I'm not saying anything bad about co-op, but I'm thinking sometimes that the information that comes out can be kind of questionable. But the other thing is that they really don't want to deal with people in pastures.
Yep.
And is that what you're finding? Is that what,
well, I totally agree with that. I think that unless you are in an area where grazing is the only agriculture in that area, you will find that most of those farm supply stores don't know their rear end from a hole in the ground, as my daddy would say, about pasture management, nor do they care to. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing, but it's just reality. So I think you're right. Yep.
In terms of the grain and range of pasture.
Absolutely. If you survey their numbers, I'm sure it would be the opposite. Other questions? All right.
Oh, Todd, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. Appreciate it.
Let's open this up to all the speakers, to Hallich, Sullenberger, Kallenbach, Russell. Any questions on this or thoughts? Chris?
I'd like to put all the speakers on the spot and ask if there was just several areas that we need more detailed information on or where we should target our research. What would those areas be?
Okay, I'm going to repeat the question, and if somebody wants to answer that, if they would speak into this because it's being recorded, say the question so I can repeat it. Repeat it so I can repeat it.
What are the holes?
Yeah, what's the top research objective to address these questions? Come on, Rob. Okay, Lynn. Yeah. You need to be recorded here. You were recorded when you said that about the hole in the ground. Did you know that?
I'm going to be a YouTube star, I can just say it.
Well, this is a little bit of a repeat, I think, of what I alluded to earlier. But I think one of the key issues going forward is establishing the relevance of grazing and grazing methods in terms of their broader application beyond simple plant and animal relationships to broader ecosystem relationships. I think there's a big hole in our knowledge base and data sets in that area. I would love to have the opportunity to do participate in a series of regional trials. Could we ever find a funding source that could put that together, where we could address some plant and animal issues surreptitiously, but with the thrust really being to improve our knowledge base in terms of soil, water, and wildlife.
I would offer three areas that I think, at least in Georgia, are most important for us to look at. One, it gets back to that substitution rate and the supplementation rate, and looking at the influence of additional grain supplementation. The second would be this aspect of fertility and spreading those nutrients around with rotational grazing is becoming way more important than it used to be when nitrogen was 10 cents a pound and phosphorus was a nickel or something like that. It's much more important now in the process that we have in this day and age. The third one would be, frankly, on horse equine grazing and severe overgrazing that goes on in those pastures, and most importantly, the runoff that we get off of those, looking at the influence of that and what kind of influence that's having on water quality.
Could I, as the moderator, answer that as well? Because, you know, we do component research, even in those experiment stations where they are systems. You know, they're comparing two systems. It's really, at some point, a component. And it would be nice to have realistic models that are simple enough to use that model within typical scenarios that account for all the inputs and all the outputs. Really nice, realistic models would be helpful, I believe. Other questions for all of this? Let's close it then by expressing gratitude to these speakers. They didn't get paid for this. They did a lot of work, and this will be published. It's probably going to benefit us for many years. And
wait, we're not getting paid for this?
You're famous now. Okay. I appreciate it. Let's give them a hand.